and consisting at the moment of a single unmade bed, a mini-fridge, and a two-burner stove. The only other article of furniture was a padded workout bench, the floor around it littered with free weights and a pair of work boots. A clothesline ran on a diagonal from one corner of the room to the sole window, and the walls were bare of decoration except for a framed certificate announcing Whelan's induction into the NYPD Honor Legion. For a fully functional middle-aged adult, the place was utterly devoid of dignity. Yet Jimmy Whelan was the most unconflicted, reasonably happy individual Billy had ever known.
"So, what's going on?" Whelan asked,
stuffing the Walther under his mattress and taking a pair of jeans from the clothesline. "What I told you on the phone," Billy said, offering him Carlos's coat, the painted handprint now starting to flake.
"The mark of the beast," Whelan said.
The toilet flushed, and a moment later one of the women from the upper apartments came out of the bathroom in her underwear. On seeing Billy, she yipped and retreated, but not before he caught an eyeful of caramel-tinted mommy fat and a generous behind. "I'll come back." Whelan waved him off, fished her clothes out of the rumple of sheets, and passed them to her through the bathroom door.
"So did you talk to the cops up there?"
"And tell them what, a guy came up to my kid? Said, say hello to your parents, and maybe, I can't swear to it, maybe did this to his jacket. Guy with a gun. I don't know that for sure. Or better yet, reach out to the chief of D's, let him bring in a threat assessment team."
"Again, based on what?"
"Then I don't know what to tell you."
"I know."
Whelan lit a cigarette and half-heartedly attempted to make the bed with his free hand.
"I mean, obviously, if there's anything I can do personally,
I appreciate it. If you ever need me to, I can stay with your family," he said, giving up on the bed. "Let's hope it never comes to that, but thank you.
Be like old times,"
Jimmy said, opening the window and flicking his cigarette upward onto the sidewalk. Back in 97, when the news of the double shooting hit the papers, and Reverend Hustle from two boroughs to the north took the ferry and set up his camp of demonstrators around Billy's Staten Island home, Whelan, like all the other WGs, volunteered on a rotating basis to stay with him and his soon-to-be ex-wife every night, until negotiations with the mayor's office brought the protests to an end, a full month after they had begun.
"So what do you think?" Whelan asked.
"About the guy?"
"About Fort Apache."
Billy paused, a beat behind the shift in topic. When Brian Rowe was the consultant on Missing Persons NYC, they threw him $400.
"A day?"
"That's what he said.
I could live with that."
"He also said as long as you keep your thoughts to yourself and don't talk to the actors, they'll keep you on forever."
"As a consultant?"
"I'm just telling you what he told me." The tenant in the bathroom came out wearing tinted cat's eye glasses, jeans, and a blouse, her hair swirled up in a damp white towel like a Mr. Softy cone. Whelan walked her the 15 feet to his door, then kissed her hard on the mouth, her knee reflexively coming up like a quarterback waiting for the snap. She left still wearing the towel.
"I have to be careful," Jimmy said. "Our husband just got out of Comstock, but I'm pretty sure he's staying with his other wife."
Gearing up to leave, Billy took back his son's jacket. "So how's your millionaire?"
"Who, Appleyard?
All of a sudden he's got three new girlfriends, two crack hoes and a tranny. I'm starting a Deadpool. $5 wins you 100 if you pick the exact day. 50 if you pick the week."
"How about the month?"
"He won't make it a month."
"Do they even make crackos anymore?"
"You should get out more."
"All right, brother,"
Billy said, stepping to the door himself.
"Why'd you mention Pavlicek today?"
Whelan asked abruptly.
"I told you it was nothing,"
Billy said, turning back to the room.
"Why are you so worried about Pavlicek?"
"I'm not." Whelan lit another cigarette.
Billy took a breath, then, "You said to me, is there something going on with Pavlicek? You said, I need to know."
"I said that? I never said that. You were the one that brought him up." Billy pondered mentioning Pavlicek's lying about the hematologist again, then decided against it.
"So everything's good with him?"
he settled for asking.
"Why wouldn't it be?"
When he was once again passing the laundry room on his way up to the ground floor, Whelan threw open his apartment door.
"Hey, I forgot to tell you."
Billy turned.
"This Fort Apache remake?
It's in 3D.
Milton Ramos. His aunt Pauline, 8 hours after an obliterating cerebral hemorrhage, lay on life support in the Jacoby Hospital ICU, flanked by her two speechless sons, Herbert and Stan. Out of blood deference, Milton stood at the foot of the bed, his hands resting on the guardrail. She was now a machine-breathing vegetable, and over the past few hours, three separate nurses had dropped by to gently campaign for pulling the plug so that they could commence the harvesting. But neither of his guilt-ridden cousins could even bring themselves to hold their mother's hand, let alone respond to the request. So when a fourth nurse came by to make the pitch, Milton cut her off before word one. "She's ready," he said. Neither son protested or even looked his way. So fucking like them. After his mother and brothers died and Pauline had brought him into her home, he had shared a bedroom with these two for years. But despite his status as a first cousin, they couldn't get past the tragedy he brought into the house with him. Or maybe it was just his mixed-race jungle face. Or maybe, like most everyone else he knew, they were intuitively scared of him. Whatever the reason, they had never accepted him as anything but a nerve-wracking boarder, as welcome into their lives as an untethered bear. At least Pauline had taken him in with an open heart. Her only bone of contention, then and always, was his sullen demeanor. Not that she didn't understand. After the nurse left, a volunteer grief counselor came by and touched his arm. "It's so hard to let a loved one go, but you have to take comfort in the fact that even though she might be leaving you physically," talk to them, chucking a thumb toward his cousins, then leaving for the street. He wouldn't attend or even help with the funeral. They could at least handle that. He had pulled the plug, and that was enough. Herbert and Stan. If they weren't dead to him before, they sure as hell were now, letting him call down the Reaper on their own mother like that. Loss and loss and loss. Each one unasked for, each one, come the end of the story, concluding with his hands gripping a scythe. "Hey, stranger." His cousin Anita, like his aunt, one of the decent ones, instantly recognizing his voice on the horn after a year without contact. "What's going on?" "Nothing," he said. "I haven't talked to you in a while."
"I know. How's Sophia?"
"You should see her."
"I'd love to.
How about we come visit sometime?"
"Say when."
"She'll go to better people. Soon." Loss and loss and loss. Milton seeing that house in Yonkers again, that smooth sailing home. Why should they be happy?
Chapter 9. Billy didn't find out about Sweet Pea Harris having gone missing until a 2 a.m. playground shooting of a 16-year-old in Fort Tryon Park took him and Mayo over the McCombs Dam Bridge to Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx. The victim's brothers were sitting in a small, dreary waiting room, three of them mute and seething, visions of payback already playing in their eyes. They knew everything there was to know about what had gone down, but he would have had better luck interviewing statues. And after 20 minutes of listening to himself talk, Billy got up from a coffee-stained couch with a blank notepad, just hoping that the aforementioned payback would occur after 8 in the morning when he was heading up to Yonkers. It was on his way back to the nurse's station that he first caught sight of the two homemade missing posters, push-pinned into the community announcements board, each featuring a low-resolution photo of Sweet Pea Harris on purple printer paper that was bottom-fringed with tearaway phone number tabs, as if announcing the availability of a dog walker. Billy took one of the posters, stuffed it into his coat pocket, and moved on down the line. An hour later, after one of the doctors came out of the OR and told Billy that the Vic would pull through, he returned to the visitor's room to see if the good news would maybe, just maybe, get the brothers talking. But they were already gone, Billy once again praying that the drama to come wouldn't play out until he was safely back in his own bed. As he was leaving the hospital,
Intending to head back to Manhattan and monitor the canvas around the crime scene, he nearly ran into an army of the victim's other relatives bursting through the front door, those in front half carrying the overcome grandmother as if she were their flagship. Billy was there for 3 additional hours, none of these further interviews yielding anything more than vaguely ominous variations on "they know who they are, and I warned him" type pronouncements. Finally, the Vic's 14-year-old stone-faced sister chin signaled for him to follow her into the ladies' room, where she locked herself in a stall for a few minutes, flushed, and then left without ever saying word one. The folded Post-it was perched on top of the toilet paper dispenser, the name and address of the shooter written in strawberry-scented neon pink with a swanish hand. 2 hours later, armed with a search warrant, Billy followed 6 Bronx ESU cops into a Valentine Avenue apartment, catching the 15-year-old actor already dressed for school, his mouth filled with frankenberries, his gun in an Angry Birds book bag. Taking the kid to the nearest precinct, the 4-6, Billy handed him over for processing, then dragged himself upstairs to the empty pre-dawn squad room in order to start banging out the requisite blizzard of paper. And when the day tour started rolling in at 8, he was still at it, blinking violently into the computer screen, his fingertips fluttering with the hour. "What are you doing here?" Billy looked up from his commandeered desk to see Dennis Doyle, a takeout coffee in one hand, a folded Daily News tucked up next to his ribs. "What's it look like?" he said, flicking a finger against the screen. "Come, take a break," Dennis said, walking to his office. Billy followed him inside, planting himself next to a stack of manila folders on the lone couch. "So how's she doing?" "Not great," Dennis said, opening his paper. "The drinking? Everything." A burly, expressionless detective came into the office without knocking, dropped a new folder on Dennis's desk, and left the room. "You know, she called me the other day, told me Raymond Delpino's sister named her baby after her," Billy said. "I know. Rose Yasmin. She told me Yasmin Rose." "I'm sure she did," Dennis said, glancing at the fresh reports. "Still, no one ever middle named a kid after me, you know." "It's the least they could do after all she's been through." "Listen, while I'm here." Billy took Sweet Pea's missing poster out of the side pocket of his sport jacket and handed it over. "You know anything about this?" Dennis read it and shrugged. "Look at the guy," Billy said. "Cornell Harris?" "Sweet Pea Harris." "Redmond Sweet Pea?" "He told me Harris was half living with his girlfriend on Concord Avenue. That's you, so I'm thinking maybe she came in here to file a report." "Hey, Milton," Dennis called out. The detective came back in the room. "Can you check the 494s for this guy?"
"Nothing there."
"Don't you want to check?"
"I was here when his sisters or whoever came in to file on him, but it was only 24 hours and they never came back, so..."
"His sisters?"
"Sisters, girlfriends," the detective said. "You should ask Maldonado, he's the one sent them away."
"Just do me a favor and check the 494s, Dennis said. "Maybe they snuck back in when you were off. If there's something there, don't be a stranger. Otherwise..."
When the detective left the room again, Dennis opened his newspaper and spoke in a low voice. "Sisters. Girlfriends," shaking his head. "A real bloodhound."
"Maybe you shouldn't tell Yasmin about this," Billy said, reaching for the poster. "It could jack her up about Cortez again."
"Are you kidding me?" Dennis said. "In fact, take it the fuck out of here when you go."
After a few minutes of small talk, Billy went back out into the general squad room to finish his reports, then thought about checking to see if Sweet Pea Harris was in the system somewhere. At first he balked, not wanting to leave an electronic trail and risk having to answer anyone's questions. But then he did it anyway, masking his search with a half dozen other names, including Eric Cortez, only to discover that neither were incarcerated or had any warrants hanging over their heads, which told him, after all was said and done, nothing. Realizing that he was in no shape to drive, Billy turned off his phone and crashed in the 4-6 bunk room, as fetid in rank as any he had ever known. When he finally made it home a few hours later, the TV was off. 11 a.m. on a Saturday morning and no one was watching cartoons. The house as quiet as a monastery.
Given that Carmen's car wasn't in the driveway, he assumed that she had taken the boys somewhere, which was A-okay with him. Then Declan, still in his pajamas, came out of the kitchen.
Dad?
His voice high and tentative.
We lost Grandpa.
What do you mean?
He's not here.
What do you mean he's not here? Did you check all the beds?
He's not here.
The basement?
He's not here.
The kid's voice starting to quiver. Millie walked into the room, Declan turning to her for help.
What's he talking about?
He's not here, she said.
Explain that. I come in this morning, the front door was open, and he's...
Why didn't you call me?
We did, Millie said. Your phone was off.
Carlos joined them in the hallway, the anxiety in the air inspiring him to hit his brother, who was too freaked by now to hit him back.
Where's Carmen?
She's out looking for him.
All right, Billy said, the heel of his hand pressed into his forehead.
All right.
His first call was to his wife, but she had left without her phone, her Killing Me Softly ringtone playing in the kitchen, which made Carlos cry out,
Is Mommy lost too?
His second call was to the Yonkers PD, the desk sergeant on duty informing him that Carmen had already given them a heads up over an hour ago.
All right, why don't you get them dressed? Billy said automatically, already roaming the neighborhood in his head.
He began by driving the residential streets nearest to home, knocking on doors and asking his neighbors to take a peek into their backyards, many of them saying that Carmen had already been there, then branched farther out, hitting the nearest commercial strips, poking his head into every supermarket, bar, and pizza place within walking distance. At the corner of Mohawk and Seneca, he ran into a trolling squad car, the only one assigned to the search, which infuriated him, the cops having no luck either. Then 15 minutes later, on a street of imposing Tudors and haciendas, he passed Carmen driving the other way, both cars hitting the brakes and nearly rear-ending each other as they simultaneously backed up at speed.
I was taking a shower. I came down. Millie's cooking breakfast. She asked me if he was still sleeping upstairs, Carmen blurted, her eyes wild in her head.
Nobody saw him leave.
All right, just calm down. We'll find him.
It's my fault, yanking on her hair and then taking off again.
It's nobody's fault, he said to the air. 45 minutes later, Billy pulled alongside a junior high school ball field and forced himself to be still.
Okay, you're him.
There were dozens of mysteries to be solved. For starters, how does a man who can barely find his way around a reasonably small house, who has neither access to a car nor the wherewithal to drive one, make it from Yonkers, land of zero subways, to Harlem, USA, on his own? But there he was, Billy's hunch playing out like a Powerball winner, his father walking up and down Lenox Avenue between 118th and 116th streets like he owned the sidewalk. For late March, the weather was downright balmy, the people mellow, and he had his father in his sights, so Billy remained in the car and watched the old man do his thing. He stopped and jawed with some old-timers who were sitting on the stoop of an abandoned brownstone, cheek by jowl to a lotteria on 118th. He bummed a cigarette from one of them, thumb flicking a bent match against the friction strip of the matchbook with a practiced hand, even though, to Billy's knowledge, his father hadn't had a smoke since 1988, the year his wife had been diagnosed with lung cancer. Then, taking his leave of this crew, he shook hands all around before moving on down the block. On 117th, he helped a young Asian woman disentangle her McLaren double stroller from a narrow doorway. On 116th, he told three kids racing scooters through a crowd in front of a ShopRite to put on the brakes. He made eye contact with everyone who crossed his path, but not in such a way as to give offense. He just wanted to let them know that he was back and that nothing escaped his notice. Lenox between 116th and 118th in 1959, it had been his first foot post out of the academy. Billy finally stepped out of the car. Hey, officer! Calling to his father over the roof, then coming around to open the passenger door.
Dad, how'd you get here? He asked as casually as he could.
My driver.
What driver was that?
Frank Campbell.
Billy took a breath. Frank Campbell is off today, Dad. afraid to remind him that his personal driver for his last 3 years on the job had been dead for a decade.
Well, then whoever was covering for him.
Breathe? Do you remember his name?
Didn't catch it.
Was he in the bag or plain clothes?
Plain clothes.
Another old-timer, this one a handball glove double amputee in a wheelchair, rolled past the passenger window at eye level, caught sight of Billy Sr., and reversed his ride until they were face-to-face. Then, winking against the smoke streaming up from his lip-locked cigarette, the guy crisply, sarcastically saluted before resuming his journey. His father was not amused.
How the hell did he make bail?
Dad, Billy tried again. Your driver. What did he look like?
Beefy, Hispanic, on the quiet side.
Billy stared out his window until the numbness passed. Did he say anything to you?
He said, Where to, boss? I said, Where do you think? But I had to tell him, so, yeah, it couldn't have been Frank.
And where did he pick you up?
Right in front of the house. Caught me by surprise when I went out to get the paper.
Think. What kind of car was he driving?
The usual.
What's the usual, Dad? The stress of keeping it light starting to make his voice climb. The old man went off somewhere.
A Crown Vic?
Billy leading the witness, but Frank Campbell always drove him around in a Crown Vic.
A Crown Vic? Billy Sr. laughed. Boy, that takes me back.
Dad, he begged.
And by the way, somebody's got to tell that kid to make sure the paper lands on the porch. It goes on the grass and the dude just soaks right through.
Billy's father was a big hit at the 2-8, two blocks west of Lenox, the commanding officer remembering him from 1985 when he was a rookie up here and Billy Sr. was the West Harlem division captain, and happily giving him a house tour while Billy, waiting for the relevant street camera uploads, made his calls. First to home, Carmen crying with relief and maybe something a little edgier. Then to the WGs, seeing if anyone could help him find a safe house for his family until this psycho was caught. At one point or another over the past 20 years, they had all given temporary shelter to each other. Billy moving in with Pavlicek and his young wife when he lost the house in Staten Island to his ex. Yasmin moving to Pelham to help Pavlicek take care of his young son after his wife's collapse and institutionalization. Pavlicek sending the adolescent John Jr. to live with Billy and Carmen when he and the kid needed a time out from each other. Later, Jimmy Whelan had stayed with Yasmin and then Redmond when one of his endless string of basement supers apartments had flooded, although no one ever wanted to move in with Whelan. Then there was Redmond staying with Billy and Carmen after his second or third wife had caught him with his third or fourth wife and set the funeral parlor on fire, and Yasmin again taking Carlos and Declan in that long-ago black summer when Carmen was unable to leave the bedroom, and Billy had his hands full simply coaxing her down the stairs. And now, once again, every one of them coming through. Jimmy offering his cabin in Monticello, Yasmin the summer house in Greenwood Lake, Redmond a two-room apartment directly above the funeral parlor. Although he advised Billy to think before you say yes. And Pavlicek, the grand prize winner, offering them their choice of 12 newly renovated flats in buildings spread out over the Bronx and Upper Manhattan, as long as he didn't mind the constant racket made by his nonstop work crews. The uploads from the street cameras, when they finally came in, just added to the mystery. The Lenox Avenue tape showing Billy Sr. arriving there on foot after having turned the corner from West 115th, the tape trained on 115th showing him once again on foot after having turned the corner from Adam Clayton Powell, which he entered from 113th, and so on. The precinct tech tracking his progress in reverse until an out-of-commission camera on 111th and Frederick Douglass Boulevard ended the trail with no sign of the car that had dropped him off somewhere south and west of where Billy had found him.
The hell with that and the hell with that! Carmen clutching her head. I'm supposed to take the kids and live where? Upstate New York? On top of some dead bodies in Harlem?
Harlem's totally different now.
I don't give a shit if it's the new Paris. I'm just not taking my kids to live in a funeral home. Where's your head at, Billy?
They were standing face to face in the toy-strewn living room, each of them alternately crouching and then shooting upright to body English their arguments, raising and then lowering their voices as the awareness of the two freaked-out kids in the house went in and out of their consciousness. "Pavlicek has a dozen clean apartments all over the Bronx," Billy pleaded. "Clean as in vacant, as in no furniture, no bedding, as in no anything." She straightened up and took a breath. "The point is, Billy, I have a job, they have school, and we're not having our lives uprooted by some sociopath. But you want to do something for me?"
"Carmen, you're here at night by yourself with the kids. What am I supposed to do? Stay home from work and sit in a corner with a shotgun?"
"I asked," she said slowly, "do you want to do something for me?" Then lowering her voice, "Your father, today, he needs to be somewheres else."
"Like where?" Billy on full alert.
"I don't know. Maybe it's time for him."
"Don't even say it.
Billy, he doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know who he is. This maniac comes along. You want to talk about who's vulnerable around here? You want to talk about the one person, the straw that's going to break the camel's back? Look, you said it yourself. You're either working or you're sleeping. One way or another, you're never here. And I can't worry about him day in and day out. And frankly, with everything that's going on..."
Again, dropping into that heated whisper,
"I can't bear him right now. I'm sorry to be like this."
"What happened today wasn't his fault."
"Exactly. You want to kill him?"
Billy's turn to start tearing up.
"I put him in a home, he'll be dead in a week. It's called assisted living. No fucking way. Then let your sister take him. She hates him. Too bad. She's got her hands full with her own mother-in-law," Billy back to pleading. "She's got her hands full, huh? Not us, though. We're sailing to Tahiti next week. Jesus Christ, what the hell's gotten into you? Get it through your head, Billy. We're not going anywhere. You don't want to put him in a place? Then you call your sister. She's his child, too."
"Sometimes you can be a stone bitch, you know that?"
Billy instantly ashamed to have said it.
Carmen at first looked struck, then furious, then left the room without another word, leaving Billy standing there, thinking, "Why is he doing this to us?" From the kitchen, Carlos started howling in fury, his older brother having just punched him in the stomach. Brenda Souza, Billy's oldest sister, showed up 3 hours later dressed in a snowflake-patterned ski sweater and stirrup pants, her face a moon of aggrievement. Her husband Charlie, a private investigator specializing in insurance fraud, a small, quiet man who always seemed to be embarrassed about something, brought up the rear. Brenda marched up to her father in the kitchen without saying hello to anyone else, wrapped him in a brusque hug. "Hi, Pa," kissing him hard on the cheek, then turning to Billy. "For how long is this?"
"Jesus, Brenda, he's right here."
"For how long?"
"He's your father, too."
"Did I say he's not?"
His sister always so angry.
"Not long." "How long is not long?"
Carmen, having no belly for her sister-in-law, left the room.
"I don't know, Brenda. There was a guy out there who picked him up today, drove him into the city, and just dumped him on the street." "What? Why?"
"I don't know, but he's not safe here."
"So how is he supposed to be safer by me?"
"Because," Billy took a breath, "whoever took him is after our family." There. He'd said it. The NYPD threat assessment team, two detectives named Amato and Lemon, arrived at the house 2 hours later. Carmen made coffee, then all four of them took seats in the living room. Billy and his wife on the brocade sofa, the detectives facing them in the matching chairs.
"Who should we be talking to here?" Amato asked Billy. "You or your father?"
"In terms of what?"
"In terms of who might be out there with some kind of personal hard-on," Lemon said.
"You talking about previous callers?"
"That or anything."
"Well, my dad's retired 20 years, so whoever had a hard-on for him is most likely dead or bedridden." The detectives stared at him, said nothing. "As for me, I mean, I put away my share of actors, but except for a few years in the 4-9, I've either been with the ID squad or in Night Watch, so..."
"Any run-ins?"
"With other cops?" Billy shrugged. "There's guys I didn't get along with, but never anything heavy."
"Can you give us some names?"
"Honestly, I'd rather not. We all shook hands in the end.
What's wrong with giving them names? Carmen asked, her arms crossed tightly over her chest.
Because there's not one of them I can't pick up the phone and call myself, he said. Because there's no need to bring up dead and buried beasts from back in the Stone Age.
Then what's the point of them being here? She muttered.
How bad off the job?
Lemon asked.
I have no idea, Billy, still arguing with Carmen in his head.
Curtis Taft? Amato's turn.
What about Curtis Taft?
You assaulted him in his hospital bed, Amato said.
I'd say assault is a little overdramatic.
They resorted to staring at him again.
I don't think he's so stupid as to come after me or my family, but by all means, do what you have to do.
There was a pause as both cops went into their notes.
How about that shooting back when you were in anti-crime?
Lemon asked, still looking down at his pad.
What about it?
There was a lot of press, a lot of angry people.
It's been over 15 years, you'd think they'd have plenty to be angry about since.
Carmen, still looking away, shook her head in exasperation. Billy having to restrain himself from getting into another fight with her, this one in front of their threat assessment team.
All right, Amato said, rising. We'll put in for a request for Taru to come out, mount a few cameras, and ask for the Yonkers PD to start running directed patrols.
How soon for the cameras? Billy asked.
Hopefully right away,
Lemon said.
What do you mean, hopefully?
All we can do is put in the request.
An hour later, Billy and Carmen were sitting on the couch, each with their arms crossed tightly over their chests as they pretended to watch something or other on TV. This was how the slow process of ending a fight always began for them, with a sullen agreement to tolerate each other's presence while engaged in a nonverbal activity, during which, at some point, one of them would make a not quite spontaneous comment about something unrelated to the argument, something safe, delivered in an offhand monotone that didn't require a response but usually got one, also to be delivered in the same flatline tone. From there, the exchanges, always off the subject of the fight, would gradually begin to pick up speed until they were actually talking, and that monotone was replaced by the natural oscilloscope of unself-conscious human speech. Formal apologies, if the situation really demanded it, usually came later in another room, or if they could get away with it, never, neither of them wanting to risk another potentially volatile encounter if it wasn't necessary. But at the moment, they were still in stage one, the accumulation of stressed silence such that when the phone rang, they both nearly levitated off the couch. It was Billy's sister calling to complain that Billy Sr. had no change of underwear in his overnight bag. That call was followed a minute later by another, this one to announce that he had no toothpaste. Then another to bitch that he had no pajama bottoms. Each had no, apparently deserving its own individual call.
What the fuck is wrong with her all the time? Carmen said, when Billy returned to the couch.
She thinks he didn't like her when she was a kid.
Only him?
The next time the phone rang, Carmen leapt to pick it up.
I swear to Christ, Brenda, why do you always have to be such a pissed-off bitch?
Then, oh, her tone downshifting.
I'm so sorry, I thought...
Sure, he's right here, right here. Carmen extended the phone to Billy.
It's somebody from Immaculate, Albert Lazar? Like I told you when I called, I would have been perfectly happy to come to you.
No problem, Billy said.
Lazar had sounded like a wreck on the phone, like he needed to unburden himself, and Billy didn't want him coming to the house and being subjected to the double-team tension of two freaked-out parents. He needed this guy to feel free to talk, and so he found himself in Lazar's tiny home office in Sleepy Hollow, formerly the bedroom of his college-age daughter, the leftover floral-patterned wallpaper combining with the teacher's visceral anxiety to shrink the already claustrophobic space to the size and feel of a sweatbox.
So, Billy, willing himself to be cool, now that I'm here.
Understand, I had no idea that you were a detective until you handed me your card yesterday.
No reason you should have.
This is kind of a long story.
How about we start with the punchline and work backwards?
Please, I need to tell it the way I need to tell it.
They were alone, Lazar's wife and son watching TV one floor below, but he still seemed to feel the need to whisper.
Otherwise, you'll never understand.
Any way you want.
Lazar stared at his hands, his kneecaps motoring.
So,
Billy said. All right, Lazar said, dropping his elbows to his knees. All right. Last week? Lazar's wife came into the room with a bowl of freshly made kale chips, her husband smiling at her with get-lost eyes. He waited for the sound of her retreating footsteps to fade before starting again. Last week, I had a few work meetings in Beacon, and I'm not really familiar with the town, but I was stuck there overnight, and so purely out of boredom, I took a walk and wound up wandering into a bar. Believe me, I hardly indulge, but I had a gin and tonic, and... And? Well, call me blind as a bat, but I didn't realize it was a gay bar until I ordered drink number two. Okay. And I was so embarrassed that I just tabbed out and left. Tabbed out, Billy thinking, not the expression of a fair-weather tippler. It's just that when I was going out the door, I ran into my neighbor, one of my neighbors, Eric, from right up the block here, and when I saw him, I was so flustered about coming out of that kind of place, all I said was, "Be careful in there, I think something fishy's going on," and he said, "Thanks for the warning, I'll stay on my toes." So this Eric Sally... Understand, I'm a very tolerant individual. I have no problem with him or anyone else being gay. Understood. So this Eric Sally is trouble. What kind of trouble? When Lazar had difficulty answering, Billy added, Is he making trouble for you? No, not yet. Maybe he's tolerant too. There's nothing for him to be tolerant about. Understood.
Look, I teach at a Catholic school in a working-class city.
Right.
A rumor gets started. Those kids are my life.
You're very popular, I know, but you're having a hard time telling me what it is you want me to know. So let me just ask, is this Eric Sally the one I'm looking for?
Looking for?
Lazar, blinking in confusion. Billy looked off, trying to control his temper. The guy was in the closet and he was scared of being dragged out. And that was all this was about. So why am I here, he said. He's trying to blackmail you?
No, but to be honest, I never felt comfortable around him, and now every time I see him, he smiles at me like he knows me. From what I understand, he's lost his job, and he's this close to losing his condo, and I don't want to go to the local police here. It would only make matters worse. So I was wondering, is there any way, in your capacity as a New York City detective and the parent of one of our students, could you maybe have a talk with him before he does anything we'll both regret?
So Eric Sally was not the guy who approached my son.
No, believe me, I would have recognized him from a mile away.
How about you? Are you the one?
Am I the one? What?
Billy got up to leave.
So can you help me?
Lazar asked. I'll make some calls, he muttered. Billy speak for go fuck yourself. And then he was gone, leaving everybody home alone like that. As Billy made his way back to Yonkers, his anger toward Lazar started to fade. The guy had been terrified, had been carrying the burden of being who he was all his life, and just couldn't imagine surviving the exposure. But gay, not gay, whatever else, Billy couldn't imagine living his day-in, day-out life with a secret so heavy on his heart that the only viable alternative was some kind of oblivion. Sometimes he worried about Carmen having that kind of weight on her, some specific interior thing that made her so anxiously alert during the days and such a tormented thrasher at night, that made every therapy session he had ever attended with her feel like a complete waste of time, filled with sulky bluster and airball bullshit, that periodically and without warning dropped a black dog mantle over her so profound that it might be days before she could bring herself to open the bedroom door. There were times when he wondered whether she had been sexually abused as a child and never told anyone, or as a frightened teenager had abandoned an unwanted baby. That's where his worst-case imagination came to an end. But one thing he knew for sure, if she could ever find it in herself to finally speak the name of her demon, she would most definitely survive. Her husband would make sure of it. Pulling into his driveway, Billy saw the silhouette of a stocky male prowling the lawn. At first, he was too startled to move, then moved without thinking, bolting from the car to bull rush the intruder from behind. As soon as he brought him to ground, landing on top of the guy in a way that forced the air out of both of them, a second figure came running from around the back of the house and bellowed, "Freeze! while simultaneously blinding Billy with a fierce beam of light. At which point the first cop got up, turned to Billy, and punched him in the head. And so he was introduced to 24/7 direct patrol coverage, Billy talking as fast as he could to avoid being cuffed and thrown into the back of the Yonkers PD cruiser sent to protect his home and family. At 3 a.m, when Billy entered the sickly bright all-night gas station mini-mart off Frederick Douglass Boulevard, the young, koofied African cashier was standing behind the counter, a half-smile on his face as he posed with cops, the majority of whom were holding out beers or candy bars for him to ring up while their partners snapped away with iPhones. The wheel had said robbery-homicide, body on the scene, but all Billy saw was the cashier, the clowning uniforms, and Stupak. "Where's the body?" "Are you blind?" Stupak answered. Wading through the posing cops, he took a closer look at the cashier. The smiling kid was stone dead on his feet, a dime-sized blood stain barely discernible on the chest pocket of his thick burgundy shirt. On the counter to his right sat a half-eaten hot pocket, still steaming from the microwave. To his left was a coiled nest of wooden prayer beads and an accounting textbook. "Are you fucking kidding me?" Billy bellowed at the uniforms. "Everybody out!" Once they were gone, Billy took an extra moment to contemplate his upright victim, then had to turn away. Staring into those unblinking yet still expressive eyes felt almost rude. "It's like Madame Tussauds," Stupak said. "You pull the store cameras?" "Of course." "Did you?" "Of course." "Any wits?" "Feely's in the back room interviewing the cabbie that called it in." "Feely's here?" Billy, surprised, but not really, having figured that after their car talk, Gene would either start showing up like clockwork just to spite him, or he'd take to heart Billy's suggestion to become a full-time no-show and never be seen again. A winning outcome, either way. "Is Butter here?"
"Give him a break, he just blew a big audition today."
"Playing what?"
"Are you gonna make me say it?"
"A detective, right?" Stupak walked away.
"Hey, Sarge!"
A uniform called out from the open door. "There's a guy out here." Billy stepped out to see a plainclothes detective in jeans and a hoodie, leaning against the door of what he guessed was a dope confiscated vintage Firebird. Behind the narc, two uniforms posted at the pumps were waving off all cars, at this hour mostly taxis pulling in to gas up.
"Sorry to pull you out, I didn't want to contaminate your scene in there." "Too late for that." "John McCormick," offering his hand. "Brooklyn North Narcotics." "Excuse me," Billy said, walking over to the uniforms at the pumps.
"These cars pulling in?" he said.
"They're probably habitual, so start taking their vitals before you cut them loose, especially the hacks."
Moving back to McCormick, Billy finally shook his hand. "So, John, what can I do for you?
I need to know your interest in Eric Cortez."
"Come again?
You ran his name yesterday? It raised a flag."
"Yeah, I did, him and a few others.
Can I ask why?"
Billy knew the worst thing he could do was lie. "I was over at the 4-6 wrapping up my fives on a shooting. I had some time to kill, so I looked up a few bad guys from back in the day." McCormick looked off, smiling in temporary retreat.
"Like Facebooking old girlfriends," Billy said. "Why do you want to know?"
McCormick let the question hang in the air, Billy not liking that at all. "Okay," Billy said, suddenly too nervous to wait him out. "I'm guessing that since Cortez is too stupid to be running any kind of crew or moving enough weight to be worth your while otherwise, he's your CI, most likely in deep for you with some bigger fish, and right now you're coming up here to see if he's into some kind of outside jackpot that he neglected to tell you about. But I'm just guessing."
"Hang on a sec," McCormick said, then walked away to make a brief phone call.
The CSU van finally rolled up, the emerging detectives heading to the mini-mart with their kits and cameras, probably unaware that the tall young man visible through the plate glass window and looking as if he were ready to ring up a beer was their body.
"Look," Billy said when McCormick came back, "it was just curiosity on my part. I probably shouldn't have run him and I'm sorry I did, but 1, I'm not looking to fuck anybody's play here, and 2, you're coming to me at 3 a.m. about this and not answering any of my questions, so maybe you can just tell me this. Am I in some kind of jam here?"
McCormick hesitated, looking at Billy as if sizing him up.
"He just needs to be protected right now."
Billy nodded, masking his relief, then became angry with himself for showing his ass like that. "Protected," he said. "You know what this guy did, don't you?"
You mean the Del Pino homicide?
McCormick pulled out a pack of Winstons. All I can think, he must be one hell of a snitch. McCormick stared at Billy for a moment longer in that assessing way, then just shrugged. Game over.
I tell you, with sea eyes, he said, offering Billy a cigarette, I try to think of it like this. All those Nazi scientists working on the V-2 rocket, we snatched them up like draft picks. Us or the Reds, freedom or world enslavement. That was the stake, so all is forgiven. Welcome to Texas. I mean, Christ, some of those krauts wound up on postage stamps.
Eric Cortez as Wernher von Braun, Billy said. That there's a keeper. McCormick semi-laughed, then slipped back into the Firebird. Billy stared at the Phoenix decal on the trembling hood for a moment, then just said it.
He's not dead, is he?
Cortez?
No,
McCormick said, giving Billy a look that made him wish he'd kept his mouth shut. Milton Ramos.
She was throwing him all night. First, she wanted to do something in bed that they never did before, and that made him blow his top in about 2 minutes flat. Then, still turned on by what they'd just done, they went at it again. They were strictly one-shot lovers, and so that was a second first, Marilise moaning all the way through. Normally, they were so silent that you could be sleeping in the same room with them and not wake up. So that right there was a third first, all three groundbreakers coming to pass in about 25 minutes. They were both by nature physically modest people, so even though they had just fucked like banshees, when she finally came out of the bathroom still naked, Milton had no idea where to rest his eyes. And instead of immediately getting dressed like she always did, Marilise just sat on the edge of the bed without making any move for her clothes.
Hey, Milton.
He had never heard her say his name out loud. Somehow they managed to live amicably under the same roof for 40 to 50 hours a week without ever saying each other's names, and he'd be lying if he said her doing so now didn't make him feel uncomfortable.
What's up? Still looking away from her water-dappled skin.
I'm pregnant.
His first reaction was that she had just become pregnant in the last half hour, which was maybe why she had taken so long in the bathroom.
What do you mean?
The question sounded stupid, he knew, but still. She didn't answer. Even in his state of low shock, he would not insult her by asking if she was sure it was his.
Okay, he said carefully. Then,
what are you thinking? Her blue-black indio hair, instead of being brushed straight back from her face as usual, had been carefully combed into long, wet bangs that made her look a few pounds lighter, a few years younger.
Because whatever you're thinking, I'll help you out.
Thanks. Still making no move to cover herself. I mean, now is not a good time for me, but anything I can do. Much to his relief, she finally began reaching for her clothes. But so just tell me, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking it's a boy.
You can tell, huh?
I have 2 sons, 7 brothers, and 7 uncles. It's a boy.
Okay.
He felt stoned, but not so badly that he couldn't deal. She stopped reaching for her clothes and looked at him full on.
Look, I don't want nothing from you, and I'm okay raising him on my own. But that means I got to go back to Guatemala to be with my family. So pretty soon I can't take care of Sophia anymore. And I can't take care of you. That's all I'm saying.
That's too bad, he said, both saddened and relieved. A few hours later, a thermos of iced yellow chartreuse nesting in his cup caddy, Milton sat in the rear parking lot of the Bryant Motor Lodge and watched as Carmen's brother Victor pulled up in an old Range Rover, stepped out, and walked across the lot to the rear entrance, just like dozens of junkies, Krakistanis, and pros-escorted Johns had done since he had set up camp 90 minutes earlier. Milton had nothing against Carmen's brother personally. In fact, in some detached way, he was happy to see him, the sad, undergrown gay kid he remembered from Longfellow Avenue, having grown into a fairly squared-away-looking man with clear eyes and a forthright stride, even at this ass-of-night hour. Victor had been easy to find. Milton just hadn't ever thought of finding him before.
A sociology instructor at City College, he had a website that described the paper he was working on, calling it a study of the quasi-family dynamics that developed over time among the drug dealers and sex workers, whose base of operations was an unnamed hotsheet motel in the Bronx. Which wasn't hard to find either, since there was a notorious cluster directly across the New England Thruway from Co-op City. And talking to a few of the regulars along that stretch yielded not only the Bryant, but Victor's working hours, which made sense, he guessed, given what the guy was going after. Propping his bat in the passenger side footwell, he slid his seat back as far as it would go, reached for the thermos, and drifted off, thinking about having unexpectedly run into Billy Graves in Dennis Doyle's office first thing this morning. After the fight-or-flight thing passed, Milton had instinctively sized him up physically, in case it ever came to that, then calmed down enough to get a rush off Billy's cluelessness. And then seeing him again later in the afternoon, this time gray-faced and shaking, when he finally found his father, still half in his pajamas, walking his old post on Lenox Avenue like a living time capsule. But Milton knew that what he had committed by taking Bill Graves Sr. from the house in Yonkers, given the man's deteriorating mental state, was both a felony and an escalation. And now he was here. Another escalation. In the past, his rage, his satisfaction, climaxed in one act, one deed. But because of his desire this time around to keep his own life intact, he had decided on a strategy of long-term, indirect payback. And in a way, this was much harder on him, leaving too much time for thinking, agonizing, for mulling over worst-case outcomes, for justifying and then retreating, retreating and then reversing. Even worse, Milton was coming to discover, each act of carefully doled-out chaos set up a craving in him to get to the next one. He felt a burning urge to keep jacking up the stakes, intensify the act itself, until he could achieve something akin to that sensation of finality he had always experienced, for better or worse, in the past. But he was losing faith in his ability to rein himself in before the tale told out, if he had ever had that faith in himself to begin with. When he'd taken Sophia to Longfellow Avenue, he had thought it was to immunize himself from himself. But now, sitting here in the parking lot of Motel Hell, he realized that it had been more of a farewell tour. If things went out of control, when things went out of control as he had always known they would, she would at least have some sense memory of the haunted house that, after 23 years, had finally claimed her father. A son. Or so she claims. Well, it was hers. And his. Scientifically speaking, but mostly hers, and he wouldn't interfere with her plans. As two of the motel guests came out into the parking lot to swap powder for head, he thought about how Marilise had sat on the edge of the bed tonight, her hair combed straight down like a squaw, then thought about that thing they did the first time, the noises she made that second time. He took another sip of chartreuse. But even if he was otherwise inclined about the baby, the way things were going, he wouldn't be around to enjoy him in any event, and the kid would just become another log on the bonfire of loss. Somewhere near, a shot went off, a car peeled out, and a man lay on his back by the dumpsters, his legs slow-pedaling the air. After a long moment, he managed to flip himself over, raise up on all fours, and crawl back inside the motel. They had always understood each other, he and Marilise. Their silence is pretty companionable, neither one ever a trouble to the other, although he always felt bad about not paying her more money. The next thought that came to Milton was so major that after reflexively grabbing for his bat, he had to step out of the car in order to clear his head. To avenge his family, he would be destroying what was left of it. The Ramos family would go from two here to two gone, which is to say, no one left. But what if instead of Ramos' obliteration, he went the other way and doubled their number? He couldn't imagine what Edgar would say about this new way of thinking. His older brother was the only person he'd ever known whose darkness was blacker than his own, the only person who Milton had ever come close to fearing, but he was pretty sure that his mother would be weeping with relief. He was still standing outside his car, bat in hand, when Carmen's brother suddenly came out of the motel, trotted to the Range Rover, and opened the passenger door. Victor grabbed a mini recorder from the glove box, then dropped his car keys and accidentally kicked them into the night. Using the light on his cell phone, he sank into a hunch and began duck-walking all over the lot in an effort to find them, Milton watching as Victor unwittingly came in his direction, his bowed head like an offering. After he'd identified himself half a dozen times through the steel door of her East Harlem SRO, Marilise, wearing a polyester nightgown, cautiously opened up, the scent of her skin lotion pleasantly knocking him on his ass. "I should have called," he said, eyeing the steak knife in her left hand.
"What's wrong?"
she whispered, her eyes wide with alarm. "Nothing. Can I come in?" He had never been here before, and he was surprised by the number of plants she kept, both hanging and potted, and not so surprised by the army of religious tokens, the medallions and silver icons that festooned her walls, the plaster saints that stood on her dresser and night table, Marilise's minuscule home like Guatemala in a box. There was nowhere to sit but the bed. He took the time he needed to compose what he wanted to say, but once he got good and going, he doubted he had ever uttered so many continuous words in his life. "So, after what happened to my family, I lived with my Aunt Pauline for a few years. She got me to finish high school out by her. I can hardly remember any of my classes or teachers, but I played a little football, and I enjoyed that. Then after graduation, I worked construction off and on. Was a bouncer in a few titty bars in Williamsburg when it was still like that. Got hired as a bodyguard for Fat Assassin, which was a good gig, until he wanted me to start lining up girls for him this one night in some club like I was his fucking sex gopher. I mean, as I look back on it, me swinging on him in front of his people wasn't the smartest thing to do, but... And then so, of course, we wound up taking it out back, which turned out very bad for the both of us, you know, in our respective ways. After that, I kind of lost myself for a year or two. The less said about that, the better. Until a girl in the neighborhood that I liked, who was a police cadet, started talking that up, and at the time I figured, well, that's one way to keep myself out of trouble. But they rejected my application because I didn't have any college. So I went to Medgar Evers in Brooklyn, but only for a year. Reapplied, got in, graduated, got my shield. Got married, had Sophia. As you know, lost my wife. As you know, taking a breather, thinking, what else, what else? With women, there was a girl, Norma, in, I think, 10th grade. That was the first time, a few one-time things. Some girlfriends, but nobody for long. My wife, of course, plus I wasn't above paying for it now and then, especially at first after she died. Then you, of course. You know. The way we do. What else? I drink too much, as you know, and I guess that's it. Of course, that wasn't it, but there would be time for telling the rest later. So, looking at her perched on the foot of her own bed, the hanging plants behind her head making him think of a jungle cat emerging into a clearing. What do you think? When he left 45 minutes later, she kissed him on the mouth, which made him jerk back with surprise, then avidly lean in for more. All these firsts. Chapter 10. There's something terrible going on in the bathroom. He can hear Carmen moaning from behind the half-open door, a low animal keen, and then he hears a frantic scrabbling on the tiles as if she's desperately trying to get away from someone. He needs to get out of bed, but he's physically paralyzed, not even able to brush away the pillow that has slipped over his face and is preventing him from drawing breath. She calls out his name in a hopeless sob, more like a farewell than a cry for help. And it's only with the greatest effort that he can even make a responding noise, a kind of high-pitched, strangled mooing that actually, finally, wakes him up. But though he is wide awake now, he still can't move or draw breath, and Carmen is still in that small room with him, and he's killing her. And Billy just cannot breathe or move. until suddenly he can, wrenching himself free from the bedsheets and stumbling into the bathroom. But of course there's no one there. Sitting slumped and shaken on the edge of the bathtub, Billy wished, for the first time in nearly 2 decades, he desperately wished for a fat line of coke. The only thing he could think of to speed vacuum his muzzy, terror-stricken skull. When he finally made it downstairs, the first person he saw was his father, reading the paper in the kitchen, which was as per usual until he remembered that the old guy was supposed to be at his daughter's house. The slam of a car door drew Billy to the window, his sister about to back out of his driveway. "What are you doing, Brenda?" Wearing a t-shirt, jeans, and sneakers, he stood by her car door in the early morning chill. His sister, having no intention of getting out of the car or even turning off the engine, rolled down the driver's side window. "I wake up this morning, I think it's Charlie laying next to me, but guess who?" "I should have warned you about that." "Oh, and let me tell you about breakfast," she said, lighting a cigarette. "We're all sitting there, me, Dad, Charlie, and my head case mother-in-law, Rita, and all of a sudden Rita says to Dad, 'So, Jeff, are we going to have relations tonight?' You know what our father says? 'Depends what time I get off.' And Rita says back, 'Well, call me when you know so I can cancel my game.'"
Billy took a light off Brenda's cigarette. Okay, so he thought she was Mom. Actually, he called her Irina. "Who's Irina?" Brenda put her car in gear.
"Do you really want to know?" Then reversing out of the driveway. "I can't do it, Billy. I'm sorry."
On his way back up to the house, Dennis Doyle called, Billy listening to him for less than a minute before jumping into his own car and taking off for the Bronx. The first thing he noticed when he raced into the St. Anne's ER was Carmen's workstation chair upside down, a good 15 feet from her desk. The second was the bright red spatter of drops leading to the curtained cubicle. At the sight of him, Carmen started yelling at the Indo-Afro-Asian interns that ringed her gurney.
"Jesus Christ, I specifically said do not call my husband, as in do not."
From what he could see of her partially averted face, there was a 2-inch cut beneath her eye and the beginnings of a nasty shiner. "They didn't call him, Carm," Dennis said. "I did." "What happened?" Billy wasn't sure who he was addressing.
"I think this might require some stitches," one of the interns said.
"What happened?" he repeated.
"Oh, for Christ's sake, it's a goddamn black eye."
Carmen backed to barking.
"Ice the goddamn thing, then let me go pick up my chair and get back to work, Jesus."
Despite her fireballing, Billy saw that she was trembling, as was he. "You caught the guy?" he asked Dennis.
"I told you 3 times, yes."
"In fact, you know what?"
Carmen again.
"I don't want you to go near my face at all. Go page Cantor."
"Where is he?" Billy asked Dennis.
"Forget it, Billy.
Is he still here? Where is he?"
"You know what?" Carmen said. "Screw it. Hold up a mirror for me. I'll do it myself."
"You have no idea what this whack's been putting us through," Billy said.
"What whack?"
Dennis, losing track. "Dennis, I just want to lay eyes on him. I won't even go in the room."
"I don't think so."
"How about this? You don't let me see him, I'll walk out of here and pistol whip the first fat-ass, do-nothing hospital guard I see."
"Gentlemen," an older doctor murmured as he slid past them and into the cubicle.
"So, Carmen," he said breezily,
"when can we expect the lawsuit?"
"Pretend it's my collar," Billy pleaded, "and that's Yasmin on that table getting worked on."
Dennis did a quick 360 around himself. "You are not to talk to him."
"You got it. Not a fucking word, you hear me?"
As they walked to the impromptu holding cell, an empty storage room down a long corridor, Dennis held firmly to Billy's arm, his tense mantra every few steps.
"Remember what you promised me."
"Did he say anything?"
"Who, this guy? Not that I know of."
"Really?" Billy said lightly.
"Not before, not during, not after?"
Then when Dennis tightened his grip,
"I'm just curious."
"Just remember what you promised."
"You!"
Billy shouted as he tried to leap over Dennis's back and get to Carmen's attacker, who, guarded by a uniform, was cuffed to a chair at the far end of the room. The grimy, blaze-eyed stick figure in scavenged clothing looked at Billy with calm eyes and total incomprehension.
"What do you want from us?"
Billy railed, this time with less heat. The guy was obviously a homeless nutter off his meds, if he'd ever been prescribed them in the first place.
"You promised me,"
Dennis said, his arms spread wide as he began chest-bumping Billy backward toward the door. Forget it, Billy said, lightly pushing him off before turning to leave under his own steam.
I'm John,
the cuffed man abruptly announced in a voice so deep and booming they both jumped.
And I bring news of he who is to come.
The best of Pavlicek's offered apartments was, as Carmen had predicted, a furniture-free one-bedroom in a shittier-than-usual part of the Bronx, but Billy didn't care. This morning's assault had thrown him into a state of shameless hyper-protectiveness, and until their stalker was caught, they were leaving Yonkers, the hell with the goddamn designated patrols, which had done nothing last night but freak out his wife, the low voices and roving flashlight beams coming through the bedroom window at all hours, making her feel like a hunted animal, which, if you thought about it, was what she felt like most of the time without any help from them. I was hoping so bad that was him, you know? Billy said, perching himself on a living room windowsill that afforded him a partial view of the outfield in Yankee Stadium, one block west of the apartment. At least it would have all been over.
They'll catch him,
Pavlicek said restlessly.
She's home now?
I had to drag her out of there, but yeah, she's home.
Doctors and nurses, they always make the worst patients, right? They think they know everything, then when something happens to them, they get all pissy and embarrassed. They're like two-year-olds. Tell me I'm wrong.
For a man seeing a hematologist, he seemed to be moving pretty good today, Billy thought. The guy roaming in a tight, repetitive circuit like a big cat in a small cage.
All right, look, I'll get my guys to bring some furniture in from the warehouse, but it might take a day or two. Meanwhile, I'm having my security guy come up to the house and hook you up with a CCTV.
John,
I can't believe you don't have one. In fact, it boggles my mind.
First thing I did when I bought my pile was put in a system. I wouldn't have my family set foot in there until it was wired like the Pentagon. Are you kidding me? Christ, Billy, you haven't seen enough shit in the last 20 years. You think you're immune? No one's immune. None of us.
When you're right, Billy said, just trying to calm him down.
Thank you. Pavlicek took a seat on one of the radiators, dropped his head, and ran his hands through his hair. When he looked up again, it was like a sleight of hand, his expression having morphed from fiercely agitated to helplessly bewildered. How you feeling these days? Billy asked.
What do you mean?
You know, your cholesterol.
My what?
I'm good. Good. Glad to hear it.
So, how are the boys?
Pavlicek said, just to say something.
They're boys,
Billy answered in kind.
Kids, all we want in life is for them to be happy, right?
Sure.
I mean, what are we asking?
I know.
John Jr., do you remember all the grief he put me through? With the rehabs, the dealing, the graffiti collars dropping out of school, and that fucking room of his. I'd walk in, him and all his friends reeking of skunk, looking like red-eyed morons. Hey, Mr. P, sitting there with the sideways hats over their ears. Hey, kids, who knows what century it is? $100 to whoever can tell me what fucking century we're in, or even just what planet we're on. They're like,
I remember, Billy said, recalling John Jr. in his teens, an oversized bruiser like his father, but in reality, a sweet-tempered con artist who'd rather munch than punch.
But I tell you, last year, Pavlicek back to pacing. I come home one day, he's there. Says to me, read this. And it's an acceptance letter from Westchester Community College. I didn't even know he applied. He says he wants to take some business classes, then get something going for himself. I tell him, come work with me. You'll learn more about starting your own business than 10 colleges. He says, nah, he wants to do it on his own. I say, if you work for me, you'll earn enough money to hit the ground running, he says. Dad, all due respect, it's important for me to do this without help from you. Can you believe that? I was so proud of him, I wanted to bust.
Hey, it was his time and he recognized it, Billy said.
Many don't. What's that?
Pavlicek tilted his chin to the side pocket of Billy's sport jacket. Sweet Pea's purple missing poster still peeking out like gaudy origami. Billy passed it over.
Cornell Harris, Pavlicek read.
Then,
that's Sweet Pea, right?
Looks like he pulled a Houdini, Billy said. Or got Houdini'd, more likely.
What the hell do you care?